WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Terry Gross. The tick-borne illness, which infects more than 18,000 people a year in this country, is known as Lyme disease, but its story began nearly a century ago across the ocean from Lyme, Connecticut. In his new book, Bullseye, Unraveling the Medical Mystery of Lyme Disease, Dr. Jonathan Edlow reveals that as early as the 1880s, medical researchers in Europe had identified rashes and confusing neurological syndromes caused by tick bites. But it wasn't until the early 70s when separate clusters of baffling cases of skin rashes and arthritis started showing up in Connecticut that doctors assembled the big picture. When deer ticks bite humans, they transmit a corkscrew-shaped bacterium known as a spirochete, which causes symptoms that vary widely from person to person. Dr. Jonathan Edlow has practiced emergency medicine in Boston for more than 20 years. He teaches at the Harvard Medical School, and he's been tracking Lyme disease since reports first surfaced. I asked him to tell us about the first cluster of Lyme disease cases in this country.
There were two Navy doctors at the submarine base in Groton, Connecticut back in the mid-70s. And during the summer of 1975, into the internist's office, Bill Mast, a patient came with a rash and a fever and sore joints, and he didn't know what it was, so he sent him to the dermatologist, Bill Burrows, who was stationed on the base. He didn't know what it was, but it seemed like something that probably should be treated with an antibiotic. And back then, they selected penicillin. Over the course of that summer of 75, they collected four patients with the exact same syndrome, a big rash, fevers, and they went through the literature. They knew about Rudolf Scrimenti's case report from 1970. They knew about some of the European data. And Bill Burrows was the dermatologist, had a habit of going to the Yale Department of Dermatology Grand Rounds each Wednesday morning. And he presented these cases because he still didn't know what it was. And one of the European doctors in the audience suggested that this was a disease that had been seen in Europe, erythema migrans.
Now, pretty much at the same time, families in Lyme, Connecticut were falling ill with similar symptoms, right? And you described the case of Polly Murray. She was devastated by undiagnosed symptoms for years in Lyme. What did doctors make of her case? And did they have any communication with these other doctors in nearby Groton, Connecticut?
Well, initially they didn't have any communication. Initially, Mrs. Murray and other members of her family, even the dog of the family, had been having all kinds of symptoms, joint symptoms, neurologic symptoms, skin symptoms for many, many years. They saw dozens of doctors. But they never, and they were given many diagnoses, but there really was no diagnosis that sort of fit. And at one point, they even suggested that Mrs. Murray was a little bit psychologically unstable. She finally persisted, and in October of 1975, called the State Department of Public Health in Connecticut.
And at this point, did all of the doctors hook up, and did all of the information end up in one place, or what happened?
No, this was, you know, before medical records were computerized. But what did happen is that one town over in Old Lyme, Connecticut, there was another woman, Judy Mensch, whose daughter, Anne, had a joint arthritis. And she was taken to the hospital. She was diagnosed with having juvenile rheumatoid arthritis, which is a fairly uncommon disease. And Mrs. Mensch had grown up in Manhattan, had known lots and lots of people, had never heard of juvenile rheumatoid arthritis. And within her one country block in Old Lyme, Connecticut, there were five children with that diagnosis. And this seemed just incredulous to her. So she started talking to doctors, and then she finally called about 1 week after Mrs. Mensch. She called the Department of Public Health in Connecticut as well.
Sociologists talk about a theory of a tipping point for social phenomena in which it launches, something launches into the public consciousness or in the case of an epidemic into the consciousness of the medical community. So was there a point with this story of Lyme at which all of these factors came together and tipped the balance for Lyme?
Well, I certainly think that 1975 would be that year. You have the Navy docs at the Groton subbase reporting their four cases. You've got Mrs. Mensch and Mrs. Murray calling the State Department of Public Health. And initially, they were blown off. They were told by the person answering the phone that arthritis is not a reportable disease, and therefore there's nothing we can do. Fortunately, that person took some written messages and left them for the person who was the acting communicable diseases chief, a man named David Snydman. And when Snydman came back from vacation, he was in Europe at the time, he had these two messages about these two women reporting clusters of arthritis. He had been trained at the CDC in epidemiology, and to him, rather than just blowing these women off, he was intrigued. He wasn't bothered by the fact that, you know, there was a round peg in a square hole. And he got curious. He called the women up, and he realized that something was going on.
How did the medical community then arrive at the conclusion that it was tick-borne?
Well, the tick part had to do with a couple pieces of evidence. One of them was that as they began looking at the evidence, they realized that this skin rash, erythema migrans, had first been discovered, or described rather, in 1909 by a Swedish dermatologist. And he had described with that original case that it was associated by a tick bite. So that was one line of evidence from Europe. The second was that both Mrs. Mensch and Mrs. Murray in their initial interviews had a mother's intuition or a hunch that there had been a lot more ticks in the area over the last few years and just sort of wondered aloud whether it could be ticks. And then the third line of evidence was a specific epidemiologic study that the departments of medicine and epidemiology at Yale undertook, which is they looked at the communities on the west bank of the Connecticut River, which were Lyme and Old Lyme and East Haddam, and they compared the rate of erythema migrans and the amount of ticks on mice and deer to that of the cities on the west bank of the Connecticut River and found that it was like 13 times higher. So the same side of the river, the east bank, had more erythema migrans and also a lot more ticks, like 13 times more. So there are all three of those lines of evidence. And I guess the fourth one is that when you looked at the patients who were sick, it was almost never patients who lived in the city centers. It was all patients that lived more out in the woods and in the suburban areas.
Now, how does the tick transmit the disease? And I understand this involves tick spit.
It involves tick spit, tick saliva. They're disgusting little creatures. And basically, when these ticks bite people, they feed for several days, sometimes as long as a week. And the bacteria, the spirochetes, migrate from the intestine of the tick into the saliva and get injected into the skin, essentially.
I'm thinking there are plenty of deer in this country. Why did this syndrome or this disease surface in Lyme, Connecticut?
Well, it's a good question. I'm not sure that I have the answer to that. Certainly in places where there are a lot of deer and there are a lot of mice and there are this particular kind of tick, it sort of brought all the elements in the environment necessary for Lyme disease to develop. There were certainly, and the other thing I should mention is that the deer herds are actually bigger now than they were, say, 30 or 40 years ago. And the reason that the deer are important is that the adult phase of the tick spends the winter on the deer. That's their preferred animal. And they mate on the deer. So the more deer, the more ticks. And in fact, the deer herds have been increasing in the northeastern United States for many decades.
Now, there is a prevailing view of Lyme that it's a disease born of the growth of the suburbs, that there are more and more highly populated suburban areas in close proximity to rural areas, and that means more and more deer in close proximity to human beings, which mean more deer ticks on our skin. And
that's
more Lyme.
Exactly correct.
And that scenario is held true.
That's true. And the same thing happened in Europe. After World War II, a lot of the forests had been bombed, a lot of the deer had been hunted for food, a lot of the wooded areas had been chopped down for the rebuilding of Europe after the war. And in Western Europe, these old world forests began to regrow, and with it the deer herds, and therefore the same sort of thing happened in Western Europe.
Now, how does Lyme generally present? What are the symptoms? And does it present differently in different people, children, adults? And I realize we're wandering into something very controversial already.
Yeah. Well, the symptoms for the most part, and this is if you were to open a textbook of medicine right now and read about the symptoms of Lyme, it would tell you that after a tick bite, if you get Lyme disease, and only about 3 or 4% of people bitten by a tick will actually get Lyme, the most common symptom is this unusual rash that's called erythema migrans. We'll just call it EM for short. And this rash often looks like a bullseye or a target lesion, but not always. It can just be a big, flat, red rash. And approximately 80% of people who contract Lyme disease will have this skin lesion.
What if you don't get the rash? How would you know you have Lyme disease?
Well, that's a good question. And some people will have just a plain old flu-like illness. And by that, I just mean a fever and chills and muscle aches and joint pains without any rash. And as you might imagine, there's probably 100 diseases that would fit that description. And one might not be thinking about Lyme disease. It's also important to recognize that only about 20 to 25% of patients with Lyme disease will remember having been bitten by a tick. So if you haven't had the tick bite, which would put you in the majority, and you have just a fever and chills, you know, Lyme disease is not the first thing that comes to mind. In addition, some people are bitten, infected, but don't develop any symptoms, and some of these patients might develop symptoms later on down the line.
Whenever there's a controversial disease that people have theories about or people are unsatisfied with the recommended conventional therapies, they come up with alternative therapies. And you trace a kind of fascinating sidebar to this story, which is that in at least one case, someone tried something called malaria therapy, which was right. Once applied to syphilis.
Correct. It's an interesting story. This man got a call from his daughter that she was going down to Mexico to purposefully contract malaria in order to treat her Lyme disease. And, you know, he thought she was nuts until he began looking into it. In fact, she was responding to a letter to the editor in no less than the New England Journal of Medicine from a physician who's well known to everybody, Harry Heimlich, the thoracic surgeon who invented the Heimlich maneuver. And Dr. Heimlich had been watching a television program one night about Lyme disease, and he said, this sounds a lot like syphilis, and began advocating malaria therapy. Well, the history of that goes back to at the turn of the century, the turn of the last century, that is, syphilis was a huge public health burden in Western Europe and here, and a large percentage of patients in mental institutions had late stages of syphilis because many of the symptoms were primarily psychiatric. And people would die within 4 to 5 years of this. There was no treatment at the time. They were treated by psychiatrists, and an Austrian psychiatrist named Jarig Wagner actually noticed that some of his patients who were early in the course of late syphilis, when they had a severe fever from some other illness, actually seemed to get quite a bit better. So he began giving patients malaria. He would take blood from an infected patient, give the patient with late syphilis malaria. They would develop very high fevers, and he found that a large percentage of them got much better, and some of them actually had complete recoveries and went back to their jobs and work. This was unheard of. This is like having something, you know, for HIV infection these days that totally cured them. So he won the Nobel Prize. I can't remember if it was 1926 or 1927, but something that seems fairly outlandish to us right now was something that won this man the Nobel Prize in Medicine less than a century ago.
So this woman, did she contract malaria, and how did it go?
Well, she did. The description of this was by her father, who said that one night she was sitting by the a riverbank in Belize for several hours at dusk and got a few hundred mosquito bites but didn't contract malaria. She actually went back to Mexico a few times and finally was injected with the blood of a child that had malaria. They used a child because they wanted to minimize the risk of other blood-borne infections. She did get malaria. She did have high spiking fevers, but unfortunately her symptoms did not get better, the symptoms that had been attributed to the chronic Lyme disease. But I think it shows you the degree of desperation that one may go to when one is having chronic symptoms.
I'm talking with Jonathan Edlow. He's the author of Bullseye, Unraveling the Medical Mystery of Lyme Disease. He's an assistant professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School. Let's take a break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. Jonathan Edlow. His new book is A Medical History of Lyme Disease. It's called Bullseye. Lyme disease is generally described as having three stages. What are the three stages, and what are the symptoms of each stage?
Yeah, they're sort of defined as follows. The early localized stage means when the disease, the spirochete, is localized into the skin, it hasn't spread anywhere. And that's where you get the rash, erythema migrans, or fevers and chills, maybe a swollen lymph gland. The second stage is called early disseminated Lyme disease, and that's when, in the early stages, the early weeks to months after the spirochete getting into the bloodstream, it causes symptoms. And those symptoms can be in the neurologic system, for example, a meningitis that's usually fairly mild, a Bell's palsy where the facial nerve becomes paralyzed and half of the face is paralyzed. Sometimes it's cardiac symptoms where you get an extremely slow pulse rate. Occasionally you can get arthritis. And sometimes it's just multiple skin rashes. The spirochete goes throughout the bloodstream and you get 20 erythema migrans lesions instead of one. The later stage is called late disseminated. And most of those symptoms are either joint problems with arthritis or neurologic problems, and they fall into two categories. One is cognitive problems where your concentration is off and your sleeping is off and you have a tremendous amount of fatigue, memory is poor. And then the other is what's called peripheral neuropathy, where you get either numbness or pains in the hands and the feet. Due to Lyme disease within the brain and spinal cord and peripheral nerves.
What's the currently recommended treatment of Lyme? And this has been really controversial and gotten politicized in the last decade. And there are basically two camps. There are people who advocate long-term antibiotic therapy to avoid these long-term symptoms, and others who say there might be no such thing as long-term symptoms and that taking antibiotics for long periods of time is not necessary. So what's the thinking on this now? Is there any consensus?
Yeah. Well, we should break it down into several categories. First of all, I think most people would agree that early diagnosed Lyme disease, meaning the first couple few months, is fairly easy to treat with antibiotics. And that antibiotics for most early presenting patients, 2 to 3 weeks is adequate. And for those that are diagnosed in the first weeks to months, sort of a middle stage, a second stage, that 3 to 4 weeks is almost always enough. Most people would agree with that, not everybody. The second piece is that it's not true that people don't have chronic symptoms. I think everybody would agree, both what I call the alternative camp and the conventional camp, would all agree that patients who have had Lyme disease, that some of them, people who are late to be treated, will have chronic symptoms. The question is, what are those symptoms being caused by? And that's where a lot of the controversy comes in. People who believe in long-term antibiotic therapy, and by that I mean months and sometimes years, believe that there are still live spirochetes in the patient, and it's the live spirochete that's causing these symptoms. There are other potential causes for the symptoms, and the conventional camp believes that it's one of those other causes. And there are different ones. It could be that there's already permanent tissue damage from the original infection, and the symptom is just due to cells that have died and are causing symptoms. It's possible that there are symptoms due to an untreated co-infection. It's possible that after the original infection, the immune system has been revved up and that it's the immune system that's causing the ongoing symptoms. It's possible that the Lyme disease has triggered some other second separate disease like fibromyalgia or chronic fatigue syndrome. And obviously, you're going to treat each of those differently. And it's also possible that some patients have multiple mechanisms of disease, or that some of the mechanisms are true in one patient, but other mechanisms are true in another patient. So again, it gets fairly complicated.
Let's talk about removing a tick. How do you do it? What's the best way? What's the recommended way?
Now, the recommended way is to take a tweezers or a forceps that are very, very thin and try to get as close to the skin as possible where the tick is and kind of pinch a little bit and then lift upwards sort of firmly. And over about, 30 to 45 seconds, most ticks will lift off. What one should not do is put alcohol or turpentine or a burnt match or Vaseline, because sometimes that will make the tick kind of squeeze the infectious contents into the person rather than not.
Well, Jonathan Edlow, I enjoyed talking with you today. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Jonathan Edlow's new book is Bullseye, Unraveling the Medical Mystery of Lyme Disease. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air.